everyone. Welcome to the Copy Blogger Podcast. My name is Tim Stoddard. I'm here with Ethan. Ethan, you are back in Connecticut, right? I should know this by now. Connecticut?
You got it. Connecticut, man.
Cool. It's good to have you back. It's good to have that background.
Cool.
Blending in with your shirt.
Yeah, I was just about to say, I'm like, this is where I was first told that my camera mount is shaky. And I just noticed, as I said, back in Connecticut, that it's shaking again. So I'm going to have to redo this desk this summer, I think. But yeah, back in the Northeast for the summer. And it's good to be here, man. We just got done with a 29-hour drive. So
yeah, I remember you doing that drive. Well, I guess the same exact time last year, which I'm having two hysterical thoughts in my mind at the same time. One is that we've been doing this for more than a year, which is wild. I think we actually have an official podcast now. And two, we're still zooming and still like have the shittiest equipment ever. Like it's all just flashing through my head as I remember last time when you were back in Connecticut for the first time and you were setting up, but I think your camera was rotated the other way maybe. And we were having the same exact conversation. You're like, is my camera okay? Like, am I good? And like nothing
changes.
Has been improved.
There's a lesson there for people listening, which is, yeah, we don't do anything, no advancement whatsoever. Yeah, no, it's good to be back up here. It is wild too. I hadn't thought about that when you said it, but we have been doing this for well over a year now. This is like 18 months in. And this is, I think, still probably, aside from the work on the newsletters, which is consistent because I get paid to do that, this is the most consistent creative output I think I've ever had over the last 18 months. So
we haven't missed a single episode. I believe you and I traded off once or twice where we interviewed people. I remember like I interviewed, oh my God, so embarrassing. His name is escaping me. The guy from How to Take Over the World. And I interviewed Bored Elon and you interviewed Danny Miranda. But other than that, we haven't missed a single episode, which actually is kind of a cool transition to something that I don't know if you saw the text I sent you, but our Fuck It, We'll Do It Live episode is trending to be our second most popular episode yet, which I'm thrilled about because I was legitimately nervous when we were doing that just because I didn't know what was going to happen, but it looks like people really like it.
Really? That's awesome. Yeah, I saw the data. I think it's for people listening. We are, I mean, still small as far as podcasts go, but substantial. So we do about, what is it, like up to 30,000 downloads a month right now, somewhere around 1,400 downloads per episode. So when we release, if you're listening to this on Tuesday, you're one of like the 1,400 people that we check in and make sure they all listen the day that the episode goes live. So thank you for that. Cool to hear that it's still kind of like ticking upwards and that idea worked out. I don't know. What do you think? Should we do more like live reviews? Has anybody reached out to you about how that episode went?
Two people. And yeah, I think we should absolutely do it. It's just cool to have this creative outlet where we continuously remind ourselves not to take it too seriously, because it always seems like the more fun we have, the more fun the listeners have. And I think that's really, really cool. But all right, man, you ready to get started? Anything else you got?
No, that's it, man. Speaking of fun, what are we doing today? I guess Here's the second lesson, people. It's like, I have no idea what we're doing today. So what are we doing today?
Well, I found a gossipy piece of news, which I think is fascinating. And I think it's also very fun to pontificate over about the future of content and the future of media. So I have three articles pulled up. I can share my screen for this for people that are watching on YouTube. And we're just going to jump right into it. Okay, so the big news, breaking news, ding, ding, ding. There has been a press release, I believe, that has been leaked that shows that Instagram plans to take on Twitter with the new text-based app. that could launch as soon as June, with project being tested by celebrities and influencers. So I'm looking at the dailymail.co.uk. It's a British tabloidy news website. You can tell that there's ads flashing everywhere, but the Daily Mail has always been one of like the UK's more long-lasting news publications. And the story was broken by this woman right here, Leah Haberman. I don't know what she does. She has a newsletter, and she uncovered what looks like a press release, like a memo that was sent out to the company, and somebody leaked it to her. So now I'm on Cointelegraph.com, and quote, in a secret meeting with select creators, Instagram's parent company, Meta, reportedly revealed its plan to launch a text-based conversation app. The leaked screenshots of the alleged upcoming app show a user interface similar to Twitter. By the way, it's not similar to Twitter. It's exactly like Twitter. Instagram's plan to rival Twitter was uncovered by Leah Haberman, an influencer marketing and social media marketing teacher at the University of California, Los Angeles Extension. According to Haberman, although the text-based app is built on top of Instagram, it is decentralized and will function as a separate app. The app will also be compatible with other decentralized social media apps like Mastodon, allowing users to reach more audiences. Lot to unpack here. What are your first thoughts as we see this juicy story about what looks to be Meta coming in on what I can only assume they assume is a weak Twitter, is like a weak ecosystem that is ripe for the taking. What are your thoughts on this?
Literally, the first internal thought was, how do you spell that?
UGH.
Yeah, with like three G's and H's. What is this? This is the second big company we've seen launch a Twitter lookalike app recently. And I don't get it, man. We'll unpack everything here. But first reaction, why are they even doing this? Twitter is a drop in the bucket compared to Facebook. So it's not like they're not trying to eat Twitter's lunch. I think that's the wrong interpretation here. I don't think they care at all about Twitter. What is there like? We should have looked up these numbers beforehand. 30 million people on Twitter? Somewhere between 10 and 20. It's right. I have no idea what it is. Yeah, I feel like I've heard it somewhere, but it's definitely less than 10% of America. So
Twitter has approximately 450 million monthly active users as of 2022, which is 396 million users more from 2010.
Social media platform's
audience has increased by more than 40% since 2018.
That's surprising. Okay, so 400 million users. That's still 10% of Facebook's active user base. So I don't think Twitter's really trying to eat, or Facebook's trying to eat Twitter's lunch. I think it's something else for this story in particular. Now, the other story that we're talking about, if people haven't heard this episode, a few weeks ago, I guess, or months ago, Substack launched sort of a microblogging feature that seemed a lot like Twitter. It looked exactly the same. The interface looked basically like Twitter. And there was a whole drama between those two, and we kind of debated why it is that Substack might do something like that. In the case of Substack, though, they're, you know, just a much smaller player. They have a lot more to gain from trying to pull people into their ecosystem. I think, if anything, this is not a signal that Twitter is weak. This is a signal that decentralized social really is going to have a foothold in the future. For a major player like Facebook or Meta to take a stance and say, we're going to create a decentralized app that can plug into all these other social media audiences, I think that's them trying to be the first major mover, because they want to own whatever the garden is that people are setting up their accounts in for these decentralized social media platforms. So I'll be honest, I'm out of my depth on decentralized social media. I know kind of the basics of it, but to me, Meta's just such a big player. They wouldn't waste their time on something like this unless it was like a big future trend that they were trying to ride the wave on.
That is a totally different insight than I had. My thought was kind of how I positioned it. So one of the things that I appreciate about Meta and about Zuckerberg, even though I don't want to make it like tribal, but just in terms of how good it is for the world, I think Facebook is like terrible. And I have a really, really hard time like rooting for them as a company just because of how weaponized it has become. With my personal opinions aside, Facebook Meta is not that good of a product company. Like, yes, they launched Facebook, which is arguably one of the 10 most revolutionary inventions in the history of the world, right? But other than that, Meta is an acquisition company, and they are brilliant at taking other people's ideas, either buying it or ripping it off and making it better. I mean, just think about it. They bought Instagram, probably the best buy in the history of business, other than maybe YouTube and Google. They completely ripped off Snapchat. Basically, I mean, has anybody heard of Snapchat since the stories were put into Instagram? Apparently, Snapchat is actually bigger than most people give it credit for. But even still, I can't remember the last time anybody said anything about Snapchat from basically the second that Meta put stories into their Instagram functionality. They are neck and neck within a year of TikTok and even YouTube Shorts with the way that they built in the scrolling media, I suppose you would call it, function. It's almost just like the TikTok effect. Everybody knows what I'm talking about. Facebook still somehow hasn't gone anywhere, even considering they blew like billions of dollars on the Web3 thing and is still neck and neck with Google in terms of percentage or like share of the market share of total advertising dollars that are sent across. So the point I'm trying to make is Facebook hasn't actually launched anything good since Facebook was invented, but they've continuously taken other people's ideas and they've always jumped up to the next level of the social media zeitgeist, I suppose is a way to call it. They've always seen what's going on and then just jumped up on it. So maybe they're seeing something similar where text-based apps are pulling in more awareness, more of the public conversation of society, and they're trying to jump on that. And like, why wouldn't they? They've basically never missed. Name a product update that they stole from somebody or just made better than somebody that hasn't had a really, really great impact on their bottom line. I mean, other than Web3 and the metaverse, it's like the only flop that they've ever had.
Other than the metaverse. So, what was that huge bet that they did on the new digital world bet. Everyone's going to live in?
Yeah. $10 billion or something?
Yeah. So that's an interesting point. Okay, what you're saying is that they are really good at observing what is going on around them and then launching new products and features or acquiring companies in order to ride the wave of these trends. And so I agree with that. I think the big question is, what is this really? What are they seeing? And what's interesting is that this has been described, I'm just surprised it's being described as a Twitter sort of follow on, because like, aside from the fact that Elon makes headlines all the time, it's not like people are really talking about Twitter as the next big thing anyways, you know? And there's basically no big part of me that thinks, I mean, despite the fact that this is a writing podcast and that you and I are deep in the written content space, for a company like Facebook to suddenly pivot and focus on text-based content seems very weird to me, because just given, you know, the pull towards video and visual stuff. So I would love to see the screenshots of what this looks like, and dig in a little bit deeper to try and uncover what it is they're actually trying to do here. Because I don't think it's ripping off Twitter. I don't think they see potential in short form text, social media. I think it's more like that walled garden of DeFi social, or not DeFi social, but decentralized social. What is that called? DeSo, yeah. I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, hold on. That's a good point. I'm going to share my screen again. Let's see if we can take some screenshots. So I am on my Twitter handle. I'm seeing this woman, Leah Haberman. She's the one that apparently broke this story. And she wrote a thread. So there are some screenshots.
Mm-hmm.
The screenshot looks like a marketing card, almost like a Google slide, or just part of a PowerPoint slide. Can I make this bigger? No, I can't. It says, so this is marketing material that was released from Instagram that would be presented to, I suppose, are the influencers that they're trying to bring on to the system to test it out. So say more with Instagram's new text-based app for conversations. I'm not going to read the whole thing. I'll just do the bullet points.
Can I pause it for a second?
Yeah.
Okay. So right there, that's kind of an interesting thing, because I don't really think that people think of Twitter as a text-based app for conversations. That's almost more like Telegram, you know, or what's the other one that people use WhatsApp. All over the place? Yeah, WhatsApp. So, which, if that's the case, well, Facebook already owns WhatsApp, don't they?
Yeah, exactly.
Damn it. I was just going to say, I could definitely see them trying to take WhatsApp's lunch. Okay, so, but right there, I think maybe the interpretation that this is a Twitter ripoff is slightly, I think it's wrong, maybe, if that's what this person is saying. But let's just keep going. Okay, so text-based app for conversations. And there's like four bullets. What are the bullets? I can't read them.
Yeah, so talk directly with your audience and peers. Bring your fans with you. Tune out the noise. Reach new audiences. And then continuing on her thread. So I think this is actually the part that you nailed here. So quote, back on Leah Haberman's, at Leah Haberman on Twitter, by the way. Back to her thread, the decentralized app is built on the back of Instagram, but will be compatible with some other apps like Mastodon. So Mastodon is this decentralized Twitter knockoff. So maybe, and now we're totally getting into some sleuthing type shit, but maybe Meta is actually trying to make the play for Mastodon, buying that company so that they can start building this walled garden, like you said, of decentralized social media, but they know that they're better designers. So they're just going to put the Instagram brand on top of this and feed it through a third-party platform. Okay, continuing on the thread. Go ahead.
Can I pause just to comment on that for a second? And I don't know anything about the technology behind how this works, but I'm just thinking through incentives. So to me, one of the tricky things that social media companies have to contend with moving forward is the idea that decentralized social media gives users the ability to take pretty much all their content, all their followers, and leave the platform. That's huge, because the big advantage social media companies have had so far is that if you build an audience on top of Facebook, you have to keep posting on Facebook in order to capitalize on the audience. That's going to change. And to me, the biggest incentive here, and I don't know if this is how this works, but it seems like there would be a lot to gain if you could somehow control or own the biggest way that creators were creating whatever that central account is. So if you think about decentralized social media, maybe we should pause for just a second to explain what that is, at least in layman's terms, because for people who are listening to this, they might not know. Decentralized social media is this concept people have been talking about for a while now, where instead of having different accounts across, say, Twitter and Instagram and, you know, Facebook, YouTube, the concept of decentralized social media is that those different outlets still exist, but you as a creator have one identity that sort of unites them all, right?
Yeah.
And so you'll see in this announcement that people say, like, oh, if they follow you on Instagram, they'll be able to automatically follow you on this new app as well. that's kind of a good example of the promise of decentralized social media, which is that you can take your audience across different platforms without having to put all this work into getting them to switch platforms. I actually don't know the mechanics behind it, but the idea is that you're not limited by the platform anymore. And then there's some other stuff people talk about in terms of like monetizing content for creators. A lot of these decentralized social platforms are built on top of their own proprietary coins, that are used to like reward content creation and stuff like that. I have been slow to buy into it for one big reason, which is that a lot of the maximalists on the decentralized social media side, they come out and they say, well, as a content creator, I create a lot of value for the platform. Twitter doesn't pay me for my content. And they should. And I think that's bullshit, because I'm like, look, if you think your content's so great, go build your own social media network that you use to reach all these people. It's incredibly expensive. You don't get paid for your content, because Twitter pays hundreds of millions or billions of dollars a year to maintain the infrastructure that allows you to reach your audience through Twitter. And so this whole concept that your content as a creator is just inherently valuable and that you should be paid by social media platforms just for posting your thoughts, I think is ridiculous. So I've been I think it's ridiculous enough that like just the business incentive isn't there for this to be anything serious. I've been very slow to grab on to the idea of decentralized social media for that reason. But now that Facebook or Meta is making this play, right? I don't know, but it kind of seems like they're the first that's a huge vote in favor of the idea that decentralized social media is going to have a significant future. And the question, this is like a roundabout way of getting here, but I was trying to explain a little bit before we talked about this, is where do you create your decentralized social media account? I don't know. I don't understand enough about the technology to say that yet, but it kind of seems like Facebook is trying to own that. And I would bet it's a little bit like a Coinbase type thing where like technically there's probably some very technical way to do it, because all this decentralized stuff's all stored on some blockchain somewhere. So there's probably a technical way to do it where you actually own all the content, and similar to the way they talk about in cryptocurrency, like if you don't own the keys to your wallet, you don't actually own the wallet, right? There's probably a mirror of that over on decentralized social, where it's like there's a technical way that you could put together an account that actually can transcend all these different decentralized social platforms, but it's probably difficult, probably not very easy. And then companies like Meta and Twitter and all these other social platforms are probably going to try and spin up user-friendly versions that offer a lot of the same functionality, but technically you don't still own the content the same way you would if you were actually out there with your own keys. That is a lot of guessing for somebody who has no idea how this technology works, but I see a lot of the same things just happening over and over again. So I would have to assume that's what we're playing with here. And if you just apply some basic incentives to like, why would Facebook focus on this at all on a platform that could technically move? If you can sit on their platform and reach your audience on Mastodon, you would have to assume that the opposite is somehow true. And if it's not true, then their solution is not truly decentralized, right? They're building a centralized solution that allows you to tap into other social media platforms. Was it the New York Times or NPR? Yeah. NPR recently left Twitter, right? Yep. And then I think there was a major newspaper that followed. I think it was maybe the New York Times or the New Yorker.
The Times lost their checkmark, and that whole checkmark, total shit show, which is the dumbest thing ever. I feel dumber and dumber that I have a checkmark on Twitter every single day, that I pay $8 for this worthless checkmark. But yeah, so apparently everybody that didn't pay was going to lose your checkmark. And basically nobody did, including deceased people. Like Kobe Bryant's Twitter account still has his checkmark, but the New York Times, they lost theirs, which is just so dumb.
I got to say, that's another thing that I think is dumb, is these people who refuse to pay. But this is going to sound so hypocritical because I don't have the checkmark, but it's not because I don't want to pay. I just haven't had the time, and I don't care enough. But I would pay. I like Twitter. But I saw a lot of the celebrity drama over, like, it comes from the same place as that whole decentralized social media thing, where they're like, I've been creating content here for years. What do you mean you're going to take my check mark away?
Dare you?
I was happy to see those people lose their, because it's $8. It's $8, you know, and the business has got to make money. And who do you think you are that you're so valuable? You just can't possibly pay for this. I get sick of that kind of stuff. So there is a part of me that thinks you could be right about the big, powerful voices on Twitter looking for a new home. And maybe Meta is trying to capitalize on that. I also think what I said is probably true as well. They probably do see some kind of future in decentralized social media. So yeah, this is big, dude. Are they betting that creators really want a central place, almost like a like their own version of Telegram, where they could create content and then distribute it across all these platforms? If so, that seems like a pretty safe bet. I think, I don't know a lot of creators who wouldn't like the convenience of being able to generate everything in one spot and automatically share it out, automatically pull their users in. That seems like a pretty interesting bet. But it begs this question about, like, what does it actually look like to create content in the future? And it reminds me of something else that touched that same nerve earlier this week. So I had a chance to sit in on a live knowledge share. We do these things at Hampton where every once in a while there'll be a conversation in our Slack channel where somebody will ask a question like, hey, how is everybody doing, say, email? Like B2B email at scale, how are you guys doing that? And then everybody, a whole bunch of people will pitch in and they'll share like what their tech stack is or what their approach is. And if it gets popular enough, we'll line up a live knowledge share where we'll have people actually like screen share and do all that kind of stuff. So there was a conversation going recently about what else? AI and SEO. And there was a handful of people in the group who are actually implementing this in a big way. So one guy is about, and I'll keep him anonymous, but he's about to lead a 10,000 article sprint on his company, which is, that accounts for like somewhere between 10 and 20% of all the content they've ever created over the last several years. They're going to do 10,000 articles in 90 days. And so he sat down to show us exactly like what the tech stack looks like to pull that off. And then another guy had completely automated his entire blogging process for like one of his sort of side projects. Same thing. So what was really interesting, there was a lot that was shared in that call. It was super interesting. But one of the things that sort of really took hold of my mind and has me thinking about the future of content creation is something that the first guy said. So he's talking about how they used to generate content, and they used to do like a lot of hiring writers on Upwork, right? They don't do that anymore. Well, they still have plenty of people who are focused on content, but their role is more of an editor. And where their freelance budget goes, get this, the freelance budget goes to subject matter experts. And I thought that was so interesting because you and I have talked about this concept a couple of times of like Google's updating their algorithm to focus more on expertise. And what does that mean for the future of content creation? What does AI mean for the future of content creation? Well, in practice, what we're seeing now with certain companies like his is that instead of paying a writer to go and research something and then write an article, they have AI write most of the article, and then they pay an editor to review that and then decide on a handful of subject matter experts that they're going to reach out to for comment. And then they'll actually pay these people to interact with them. So like if you go to Fiverr or Upwork or something, it's a really quick and easy way to find subject matter experts. But that is so interesting because it's like the AI writing handles a lot of the old stuff from the Google algorithm, right? But the expertise thing was going to be the hard nut to crack for AI because it doesn't actually understand what it's writing about. What I'm seeing just from his example, and I'd be curious to see if we see more of this, is that the nature of content creation is going to shift back towards the voices of subject matter experts who are experts in their field. And having those people in the piece is going to be much more important than it was before, because it's going to be the only thing that differentiates your content from anybody else's, which is so interesting, right?
Yeah.
So the reason I bring that up is because that makes me think the same thing that this Instagram move makes me think, which is like, what does the future of a content company really look like in terms of the day-to-day action of how things are created? I think on the Instagram side, this is definitely going to drive some really interesting changes that I'm curious to see. But man, that thing about hiring subject matter experts was, it was like a light bulb moment for me, man.
Yeah, that is a light bulb moment. I still, in the back of my mind, can't shake the idea that AI will make people more important instead of less important. It's just you have to be worth something. And you hate to put value on humans like that, but just in terms of the marketplace, considering you're trying to be in the business of either content creation or information sharing, or I mean, gee, everything really. Why limit it to that, right? You have to have, as Naval would say, hyper specific knowledge, which is the intersection between the things that only you can know simply by being you and having your experiences, crossed by a specific skill set that you can bring to the market. Like, how are you going to be able to do things that only you can do in the way that you can do them that nobody else can? And I'm with you. That is so interesting. You're not about skills anymore. You're about a specified expertise. And yeah, I think we'll see that everywhere.
Well, isn't that interesting how the last 10 years or so was really about generalized knowledge, right? It was great to be a jack of all trades. And in some ways, I think it still will be because things change so fast. You have to be really good at learning and you're going to have to know a lot still. But it's almost like the crux of your career will continue to depend on deep expertise in certain areas. And that can probably change, I'm betting, over the course of your career. Like, you could develop early expertise in one area and continue to redefine yourself every 5 years or so, right? But in order to be really relevant in this world, it does seem like you're going to need to be known for a thing. And that is where all this comes back into play, you know, the content creation, audience building, all that stuff. Because if companies are relying on like subject matter experts in order to get noticed, then the question is, how do they figure out who those subject matter experts are, right? Mm-hmm. And if you happen to be the company looking for the experts, there's going to be a whole bunch of interesting questions there. But if you're one of the people that's trying to be kind of recognized and consulted for your expertise, everything that we talk about here is going to be super important, I think. And so in that way, I agree with you. This AI is definitely going to change a lot, but the one thing it won't do is like pull people out of the equation. It's just changing how you go about getting recognized and what the actual work looks like.
Pretty on point to the other thing that I was considering talking about today, if we had time. And it's so interesting that you brought that up, because I was talking to Jules about the same thing, and I'm absolutely making that bet. I've spent the last 10 years experimenting with a bunch of stuff. You know, I've built local media stuff, I've built content stuff, I've built moving stuff. I mean, I've created a business that sells courses about the LSAT, all types of shit. And I've made, and maybe it's also because I'm getting a little bit older, where you realize that, I know I've said this quote before, you can have anything you want, you can't have everything you want, you know? And so I have made the decision to double down on the behavioral health side of my life, creating just domain expertise in that, being one of just the most sought after experts in that space in the entire world. Obviously, there's the content side of me, which is kind of universal to everything, but I'm so far into it at this point in my life that I'm not just going to give it up, right? But I'm struggling a lot because now I don't know what to do with my personal writing. I spend so much time that we've spoken about on this podcast with my newsletter and with timstods.com and with having a voice for myself. And now that the copy blogger is deal is fully done, that voice has like instantly transitioned to such a bigger audience. And I know I need to keep it personal, just like we talked about, because as soon as you start commoditizing your brand, you're going to be just like everybody else. And so these two areas of expertise of mine, that's where I am. And I don't think that's, I think I'm here for at least 10 years until I either cash out or burn out or whatever happens, you know, but I don't know what to do anymore with my site, with timstodds.com. And it's creating me more creative anguish than I expected it to, because it's just a website, you know, it's what everybody says, well, man, it's just a big deal, just write stuff. But you know how it is, you put all this time into something and now I feel like it's not there anymore. So I know I'm switching subjects on you real quick, but since you brought it up in this idea of like industry experts, who am I now? Like, who is timstodds.com? What the hell do I do?
That's a big question, man.
Who am I?
Yeah. Hey, real quick before you go, can you just give me a quick idea of who am I? What should I do? And what's the meaning of all this? I don't know, dude. To be honest, I almost want to kick this into a new episode so we can dig deep on it. Like, what have you done so far? You've basically moved your personal publishing over to Copyblogger. And you're the face of Copyblogger now. That's right? That's accurate?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't done the whole branding aspect on the website, but you know, I think you're right. I'd love to do another episode on this, because here's really where my thinking has been. These are the ideas that are toying around in my head. We've all heard so much about personal brand the last 10 years, but do these changes make personal brand more important or less important? And this is like that crux, this is the crossroads for me, where do I invest in this website, this brand that I can bring with me everywhere, with the assumption that I can have the flexibility to bounce around in different industries, you know, because my body of work can follow me? Or do you just bank on the fact that no, you have to pick something and be the best at that, because all of the other stuff is potentially going to be wiped out. You're right. Maybe we should talk about it in a different episode, because that's a big conversation.
That is a big conversation. Let's do that. Let's do that for the next episode. We'll bring it back to that. And I want to explore not only how AI will impact that, but like there's an aspect of this that's related to career maturity too, right? Like, personal brand has a different meaning when you're early in your career than it does when you're later. And as somebody who now runs a big company that's a big public facing sort of surface area, I think there's a really interesting conversation to have there about how priorities shift across a creative career. Because I feel like I'm running into a version of this too. There's something that we talk about here a lot, which is like overlapping your professional work with your passion work long enough that the passion stuff eventually gets big enough that it can become the professional side. And I have screwed up on that in the past, right? Left a job to just start a creative endeavor, ran out of money, and, you know, learned from that. Everybody's done that in the creative space at least once, I think. I've also done the opposite and like done creative stuff on the side while carrying a job. And what I found recently is that there does come a point in your career where if you're making progress on these creative things, you do hit that tipping point where all of a sudden you are able to actually make the leap, and then you kind of have to make a decision about whether or not you're going to do it. And depending on what decision you make, your priorities for everything else shift in a way that a lot of people just don't talk about. So for me, I've chosen to continue working a job, even though I'm at a point right now where, you know, I have somewhat of a reputation for this, like content newsletter stuff. People do reach out, they ask to work with me. At this point, I don't take on that work, right? So what does that mean for personal brand if you have a brand, but you are not trying to monetize it? I think there's a lot of really interesting ground to explore there. And it's in some ways similar to what you're doing. I think you're doing it at a bigger scale than I am, which is that your personal brand has now become inextricably tied to this big company that you're running. What does that mean for your personal body of work outside of Copyblogger? What should it mean? And then for the listeners, hopefully we can make this relevant to them too when we get into it, which is like, if you're in this earlier stage where you're kind of building up the portfolio while working a job, how do you know when you hit the transition point? And then if you're later on in your career and maybe, you know, most of your work is tied to some large brand that you built, what does that mean for the personal side of your work as well? We'll just dig into all of that next week.
Sure. That it brings up so many other topics that I think people struggle with. Yeah, great. Great episode. This was definitely more wide ranging than we've been recently, but there's just so much going on in our space right now that it's hard to keep up, and I am strapped in for the ride. I'm half terrified, half super excited about it, cause I think it's going to be a blast, but we'll see.
We'll see what happens. Yeah, man. All right. Well, there you have it, people. We'll see what happens. Thanks for tuning in. We'll talk to you next week. And if you have thoughts on why Meta made this move, reach out to us and let us know. There's one more thing I was going to say too. I'm going to say one more thing too. Seriously, if you're listening to this, reach out to us. There's not a lot of people that reach out to us. So if you like this podcast and you want to say, hey, you want to share an idea or whatever, your message is not going to get like lost in the mail. Reach out to us. Say, hey, you want to know who's listening.
Appreciate you. Thanks, Ethan. Great to see you. And we'll talk to you next week. See you.
Yeah. Later, guys.